Absolutely not. The policy of the United States government is clear, unambiguous, and opposed to the activities that you described. The second question.
Well, how do you explain the fact that DynCorp and its successor companies have received and continue to receive government contracts?
I would have to go and find the facts, but there are laws and rules and regulations with respect to government contracts, and there are times that corporations do things they should not do, in which case they tend to be suspended for some period. There are times then that the under the laws and the rules and regulations for the that passed by the Congress and implemented by the executive branch, that corporations can get off of out of the penalty box, if you will, and be permitted to engage in contracts with the government. They're not generally not barred in perpetuity.
This company was never in the penalty box. If you could proceed to my second question, please.
DynCorp was not placed in the penalty box and was soon back to its old tricks. In 2009, WikiLeaks cables revealed that DynCorp was arranging sex parties for Afghan politicians involving small boys. One of these politicians was the Minister of Education. Nor has the intelligence bureaucracy itself remained idle since the founding of the CIA. Under the Reagan administration, a new player emerged, JSOC, or the Joint Special Operations Command. JSOC was ostensibly created as a response to the failed 1980 hostage rescue attempt of American embassy personnel in Iran. It went on to conduct operations in Honduras, El Salvador, Nicaragua, and countless other nations.
The basic premise that I was saying is there's a unit known as the Joint Special Operations Command, JSOC. It's a separately independent unit that does not report to Congress, at least in the years I know about, and I spent, if people read a story I wrote last summer in the New Yorker, the Congress people are very upset, the senior leadership. It has been given executive authority by the president in as many as 12 countries to go in and kill, we're talking about high-value targets. That's absolutely correct.
Recently, it was revealed that JSOC has been training members of the MEK, an Israeli-backed terrorist group on U.S. soil, at the very same time that MEK was cited on the State Department's own list of terrorist organizations.
If they're killing people that we like, it's not terrorism. By the way, we should add that the Brits and even the EU have basically moved away from that terrorism name because, again, they like having these guys. I mean, if somebody else can do the dirty work and you can make an absolute denial, as we have seen from the likes of our Secretary of State, who said, we are absolutely not involved in the assassination of these five scientists, and we have absolutely said it definitively, isn't it nice to have an organization? I'm not suggesting this is the organization, but it's nice to have an organization that can do something so you can say, it wasn't me, it must have been somebody else. You know what I mean?
The United States now has 16 separate intelligence agencies, ranging from the ONI, the Office of Naval Intelligence, to the DIA, the Defense Intelligence Agency. Admiral Dennis C. Blair, whom President Obama appointed Director of National Intelligence, disclosed in 2012 that the current annual budget for America's 16 intelligence agencies is a remarkable $75 billion. More than the entire military budgets of major powers, such as the UK, France, and Germany. It employs more than 200,000 operatives worldwide, many of whom are mercenaries.
Robert Steele, former CIA.
Giving the intelligence community more money is like pouring gasoline onto a fire. It is a really bad idea. But there's no oversight. There's no accountability. And therefore, they'll go on. I mean, General Hayden, who's now violated the Constitution twice, once with wireless wiretapping, the second time with torture and rendition. Hayden is on record as saying that any time he wanted to close down a program at NSA, the guy who would lose his status and his money and his program was the only one who could tell him about it. So no oversight has really created a monster. There are 16 intelligence agencies. It turns out that the State Department, which costs almost nothing, produces the most value with open source intelligence, with information that is not stolen and is legal and ethical. Then you have the CIA, which has a mishmash of analysis and a mishmash of clandestine collection. And then after that come the technical agencies. The National Security Agency, which does signals intelligence, including warrantless wiretapping, and some other elements. And the long and the short of it is that we're spending $60 to $75 billion, of which CIA spends no more than $6 billion. And we're spending it on things that don't work. Lockheed will spend $100 million of the taxpayers' money on a satellite, and it'll self-destruct on the launch pad, and Lockheed will be given a contract to build another one. I mean, this is nuts. Policymakers are so stupid, they would rather a secret picture than an intelligent human analysis. And so the whole system is rotten. The next president can safely cut the secret budget by 80% and move that money into education and open sources and do vastly better, not just for America, but for the rest of the world to whom that information can be given for free in sense-made form. So right now, our government is completely out of touch with reality, and it's the Keystone Cops on steroids and armed. Okay? I mean, we're really in deep, deep trouble here. Have a nice day.
It's the infamous CBS report from 2001 that we featured in episode 568.
Rumsfeld promised change, but the next day, the world changed. And in the rush to fund the war on terrorism, the war on waste seems to have been forgotten.
My 03 budget calls for more than $48 billion in new defense spending.
More money for the Pentagon when its own auditors admit the military cannot account for 25% of what it already spends.
According to some estimates, we cannot track $2.3 trillion in transactions.
$2.3 trillion, with a T. That's $8,000 for every man, woman, and child in America. 20 years ago, Pentagon employee Franklin C. Spinney made headlines exposing what he calls the accounting games. He's still there, and although he does not speak for the Pentagon, he believes the problem has gotten worse.
Those numbers are pie in the sky. The books are cooked routinely year after year after year.
Retired Vice Admiral Jack Shanahan commanded the Navy's Second Fleet the first time Donald Rumsfeld served as Defense Secretary.
With good financial oversight, we could find $48 billion in loose change in that building without having to hit the taxpayers.
In the 2.5 minutes since this report began, the Pentagon has spent nearly $2 million, and it may never know where 25% of those tax dollars went.
A quote from William Burroughs: a bureau takes root anywhere in the state, turns malignant like the narcotic bureau, and grows, always reproducing more of its own kind, until it chokes the host, if not controlled or excised.
When it comes to waste by a particular agency, few can rival the NSA, or National Security Agency. Its headquarters, nicknamed Crypto City, employs over 40,000 people, more than the CIA and FBI combined. As documented by journalist James Bamford, it encompasses 525 acres with floor space totaling more than 7 million square feet. Its yearly consumption of electricity is 409 million kilowatt hours, equaling Maryland's capital, Annapolis. It has its own film festival, yacht club, and ski club, with yearly trips to Austria and Switzerland. Its budget for 1995 to 1999 totaled $17,570,600,000. Apparently, not even this was enough. In 2012, Wired magazine reported that the NSA was building an even more gargantuan complex in Utah. A former NSA official, quoted in the article, claims that the United States is now a hair's breadth from becoming a turnkey totalitarian state. Though the official mandate of the NSA is to eavesdrop on foreign communications, we now know that it has long been pointing its instruments inward. In the Philippines, circa 1950, CIA Cywar operative Ed Lansdale employed a technique known as the Eye of God. At night, operatives would paint an eye on the wall of a house facing a suspected communist or communist sympathizer. The message, "We are watching you." In some respects, the NSA's well-publicized spying on American citizens has the same effect. In the late 18th century, an English social theorist named Jeremy Bentham designed a prison known as the Panopticon. It was a circular structure with a central command center built so that prisoners would never know if they were being watched. French philosopher Michel Foucault stated that the goal was to induce in the inmate a state of conscious and permanent visibility that assures the automatic functioning of power. Regardless of intent, NSA agents can only analyze a tiny portion of the information they intercept. Yet, the very fact that they have claimed the right to spy on American citizens is a gross violation of their mandate. Similarly, the CIA, which is prohibited from conducting internal security functions within the United States, has repeatedly broken its own rules. Under Operation Chaos, the agency spied on leftists during the Civil Rights era. Under MKUltra, they used thousands of American citizens as human guinea pigs. During Operation Mockingbird, they illegally propagandized the American public.
From the 1975 House Intelligence Committee hearing.
Do you have any people being paid by the CIA who are contributing to a major circulation American journal?
We do have people who submit pieces to other two American journals.
Do you have any people paid by the CIA who are working for television networks?
This, I think, gets into the kind of getting into the details, Mr. Chairman, that I'd like to get into in executive session.
It is a great honor to be here with the men and women of the CIA. I've been eager to come out here to Langley for some time so I can deliver a simple message to you in person on behalf of the American people. Thank you. Thank you for all the work that you do to protect the American people and the freedom that we all cherish.
Today, it is widely accepted that secret organizations with extraordinary special powers are necessary for stability, for democracy, and for defense against foreign enemies. Yet this viewpoint has not always been the dominant one. In A Modern History of England, published in the 19th century, its author notes, "Nothing is more revolting to Englishmen than the espionage which forms parts of the administrative system of continental despotisms. The freedom of a country may be measured by its immunity from this baleful agency." Similarly, in 1798, a congressman colorfully warned that if a system of espionage is established, the country will swarm with informers, spies, and all the odious reptile tribe that breed in the sunshine of despotic power. If the corporatocracy has become the de facto emperor of the United States, the shadow government has become its elite guard. In the late 1980s, CIA whistleblower John Stockwell compared the military intelligence complex to the praetors of ancient Rome. "The praetors came to exercise great power," Stockwell wrote, "making and unmaking emperors and allowing political and military action outside of the law. What rules that were observed were announced by the issuance of edicts." The guard was characterized by corruption and political venality, and was closed down by Constantine in 312 AD. 353 years earlier, Julius Caesar crossed the River Rubicon Roman law specified that only elected magistrates could hold imperium or right of command in their provinces. Therefore, Caesar's act directly challenged the power of the elected government. Today, the idiom crossing the Rubicon is used to describe the devolution of a republic into an empire. It is also used to mean a point of no return.
Part 2 of Counterintelligence, The Deep State, begins with a quote from Al Capone. Quote, "This American system of ours, call it Americanism, call it capitalism, call it what you will, gives each and every one of us a great opportunity, if only we seize it with both hands and make the most of it." We begin with Oliver North speaking into the hearings on the Iran-Contra affair.
The director was interested in the ability to go to an existing, as he put it, off-the-shelf, self-sustaining, stand-alone entity that could perform certain activities on behalf of the United States.
Are you not shocked that the director of Central Intelligence is proposing to you the creation of an organization to do these kinds of things outside of his own organization?
Counsel, I can tell you I'm not shocked.
They called it Iran-Contra. For many Americans, it provided their first peek behind the curtain of the national security state. Others were old enough to remember similar scandals.
I believe Congress set up the FBI to determine what was going on in this country, didn't it?
Among other things, Mr. Chairman.
It set up the CIA to determine what was going on in respect to foreign intelligence, didn't it?
Yes, sir. And a number of
but
others.
But it didn't set up the plumbers, did it?
Of course, the Congress doesn't do everything, Mr.
No,
Chairman.
No, but Congress is the only one that's got legislative power, and I don't know anything, any law that gave the president the power to set himself up what some people have called a secret police, namely the plumbers.
Perhaps the most important investigation into America's burgeoning secret government was the Church Committee. In 1975 and 1976, it published 14 reports on U.S. intelligence agencies.
You were specifically asked about shellfish toxins and shellfish poisons. You say it's inconceivable that a secret intelligence arm of the government has to comply with all the overt orders of the government. Is that an accurate quote or not an accurate quote?
Well, if it's accurate, it shouldn't have been said.
Well, now, I... So, looks like we're on plausible denial again, is all I can say here, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Frank Church.
Quite a lot of detailed information, and we will evaluate it, and we will include any evidence of wrongdoing or any evidence of impropriety in our final report and make recommendations.
Whatever the intentions of the committee, very little changed. By the mid-1980s, it became apparent that the intelligence bureaucracy had not been reined in by the Church Committee. Rather, like a black flower in the dark, it had blossomed.
Bill Moyers in 1987.
They did all this in the dark because it would never stand the light of day. Secrecy is the freedom zealots dream of. No watchman to check the door, no accountant to check the books, no judge to check the law. The secret government has no constitution. The rules it follows are the rules it makes up. So William Casey could dream that the enterprise might take on a life of its own, permanent and wholly unaccountable.
The Iran-Contra scandal revolved around the illegal sale of arms to Iran and the equally illegal funding of the Nicaragua Contras. Under the Boland Amendment, funding of the Contras had been prohibited by Congress.
Correct, Mr. Secord, that from December 1984 until July 1985, you were engaged in selling arms to the Contras for profit.
That's correct.
Prior to the rise of the Sandinistas, members of the same family had ruled Nicaragua for over 40 years. The Somoza clan had monopolized almost every industry in the country, stealing millions from their own people. When Anastasio Somoza II was finally overthrown and fled to Miami, a U.S. intelligence report placed his net worth at nearly $100 million. Anastasio had been a particularly sadistic ruler. One of his favorite methods of execution was to throw dissidents from helicopters into the Messiah volcano. In 1979, the people revolted. The Sandinistas undertook radical reforms. They established the first public education system for children, building thousands of schools and playgrounds. They cut illiteracy to less than 10% of the population. They cut infant mortality by a third. They established a national health service. They abolished the death penalty. They allowed the development of independent cooperatives, increasing food production by over 100%. And they enjoyed the support of the vast majority of Nicaragua's people.
This revolution was not made by a proletariat party. It was produced by a popular insurrection. Everybody took part in the destruction of the dictatorship. This is not a political party. It's a front who made the revolution. And you have in this front different parties, the Socialist Party, the Christian Democratic Party, the Liberals, the Conservatives, all of them took part in this insurrection. Christians, the same time with Marxists, took part in this insurrection. The church, many priests and nuns supported the insurrection, even fought in the insurrection.
After a study of 76 developing countries, Oxfam stated that Nicaragua was exceptional in the strength of that government's commitment to improving the condition of the people and encouraging their active participation in the development process. But it was not to last. Fearing that the Sandinista model may spread to other countries, former Treasury Secretary George Shultz called the Sandinistas a cancer right here on our landmass. Trained in neighboring Honduras as well as back home in Florida, the Contras would unleash a reign of terror on the people of Nicaragua. They focused heavily on economic targets. Missions included the blowing up of oil pipelines, the illegal mining of Nicaraguan ports, the burning and bombing of grain silos, farmhouses, and machinery, and numerous other wanton attacks. It is possible that the Nicaraguan people may have been able to withstand these assaults, but the brutality of the Contras took its toll.
So I guess in a way they are counter-revolutionary, and God bless them for being that way. And I guess that makes them Contras, and so it makes me a Contra too.
As long as there is breath in this body, I will speak and work, strive and struggle for the cause of the Nicaraguan freedom fighters.
A later Congressional Intelligence Committee revealed that the Contras had raped, tortured, and killed unarmed civilians, including children, and that groups of civilians, including women and children, were burned, dismembered, blinded, and beheaded.
There was an election here in Nicaragua in 1984, and I think most people have probably forgotten that, because there was some a brilliant piece of agenda setting up in Washington, whereby they suddenly decided that the Sandinistas were getting MiGs into the country. And although the entire press corps down here knew that this wasn't true, because it had been announced in Washington, we were all obliged by our foreign editors and news desks to go running up to the port and investigate the arrival of these mythical and non-existent MiGs. And the whole election coverage was abandoned. So everybody had covered the entire campaign, but everybody ceased to cover the election itself because Washington very cleverly changed the issue from the issue of democracy in Nicaragua to the issue of national security.
ABC Nightline from 1984.
The United States has circumstantial evidence suggesting that as many as a dozen Soviet MiG-21 jets may have arrived today at the Nicaraguan port of Corinto.
If the most immediate goal of the Reagan administration was to topple the government of Nicaragua. The details of their destabilization campaign were equally alarming. Testimony would reveal a network of criminal enterprises involving drug traffickers, money launderers, organized crime figures, and death squads, all working in concert with America's secret government. Independent journalist Danny Cozzolaro, who allegedly committed suicide during an investigation into Iran-Contra and related scandals, described this network as the Octopus.
August the 15th, 1991, on CBS.
Authorities are investigating the mysterious death of a journalist and possible connections to the BCCI bank scandal and the Weapons for Iran case. Wyatt Andrews tells us that puzzling tale.
Freelance journalist Danny Casolaro told friends he was on to the political conspiracy of the century. He was meeting a source in West Virginia. He was about to discover all. Instead, his body was discovered in a hotel room with 12 slashes in his wrist. But when the local authorities ruled it suicide, the family said, no way. The housekeeper had taken calls threatening his life.
And I pick it up telephone, I say hello, and he say to me, you son of a bitch, you's dead.
Despite that sounding straight from the movies, the medical examiner today held to the suicide finding, saying Casolaro apparently was alone.
There were no other contusions, lacerations, or other trauma to the body that would indicate a struggle.
In my heart, I remember Danny telling us, if I'm in an accident, don't believe it.
Casolaro was probing a conspiracy he called the Octopus, which involved the Iranian hostage crisis, the Iran-Contra affair, with, believe it or not, all funds channeled through BCCI, the international bank charged with everything from money laundering to fraud.
Good afternoon.
The common thread within Octopus is the infamous Inslaw affair, when a court ruled the Reagan Justice Department stole valuable law enforcement software from the Inslaw Corporation. Casolaro's theory is that right-wing zealots sold the software for profit. The money went to Iranian officials who supposedly delayed the release of the American hostages back in 1981, the so-called October Surprise, and later went to the back-channel funding of the Contras.
About all the papers he had with him, the investigation he was doing, and the sergeant was clearly, really didn't have any idea about this, and at that point told me they found no papers in his room.
The papers Casolaro had with him in Martinsburg included hundreds of notes and documents from more than a year of investigation. Not one has ever been found.
Jack Anderson, journalist.
From the moment we heard about his reported suicide, we doubted it, questioned it, wondered about it. It was not his nature to kill himself, so we were suspicious from the first, and the deeper we dug into it, the more suspicious we became. Suspicious circumstances surrounding the investigation of his alleged suicide.
Danny Casolaro's fear of blood tests and other minor medical procedures was well known to his family. They found it incomprehensible that he committed suicide by slashing his wrists a dozen times. Just days before his death, Danny Casolaro enthusiastically told friends he was close to breaking the story that had consumed him the past year. It had started as an inquiry into computer software theft, but soon mushroomed into a broad investigation of government corruption that Casolaro believed implicated U.S. Justice Department officials.
Peter Dale Scott, author of The Road to 9/11.
The deep state is much easier to define in a country like Turkey, where in addition to the regular government, there is a concealed apparatus which unites the intelligence networks with drug mafias and other people capable of carrying out killings. In America, it's more complicated. I would say that in America, we use the term deep state to refer to that whole complex of ways in which power is exerted off-camera by people who are not elected, who are not part of the Constitution or the bureaucracy, but have real power and assert themselves from time to time in American politics.
This is, or was, the section where Phoenix City's principal industry flourished and gave employment to a part of the town's citizens. Some worked in factories like this one, making the industry's tools, dice, shaved by skilled hands, or loaded with mercury. Slot machines rigged to pay off 1 cent on the dollar, if at all. Whiskey that looked like bonded stuff but wasn't. Cards marked with tiny pinpricks or trims so the dealers could recognize the aces and face cards. Tools of an industry that flourished for half a century because the good men looked the other way. An industry run by men I went to school with. Their fathers ran it, and their fathers' fathers before them. An industry that made Phoenix City the most vicious town in the United States. That industry was vice.
John Judge from the Coalition on Political Assassinations.
The old Italian mafiosi that came here were part of what they considered a societa honorata, and they didn't believe in prostitution or drugs. They didn't mind breaking your leg over a loan or loan sharking or gambling, but they had certain crimes they wouldn't participate in and they thought were beyond the pale. But there was a night in the 30s that was called the Night of the Italian Vespers, and about 30 top old mafia dons were murdered the same night. The FBI knew something was coming because Lucky Luciano bought $1,000 worth of flowers the day before. And they killed all these old mafia, and then they created a new, more cross-ethnic mafia that rose under Luciano and Meyer Lansky, and included the Jewish mob and had other connections to international money. The old mob was useful too at that point and more aligned with the FBI. And Hoover said that there was no such thing as organized crime, and so never pursued the mob. He liked to gamble on horses, and he and Clyde Tolson would go to Del Mar, the mob-owned racetracks, and they'd put him up and give him free gambling money, in the same way that Nixon was taken by the Florida mob down to gamble in Cuba before the rise of Castro.
Derby Day in old Kentucky, and Churchill Downs is the mecca for 60,000 race fans. And here's head G-man J. Edgar Hoover with a last-minute tip for Dan.
And they befriend people and surround people in the political circles, help them get into office so that they could have some political influence. But during World War II, the Office of Naval Intelligence made deals with Lucky Luciano to supposedly protect the docks of New York from German saboteurs, since the mob was in control of the labor on the docks. The mafia then also was assisted by Patton, General Patton, who came into Italy and got the foothold in Italy by coming up into the mountains instead of going down into the cities.
I want you to remember that no bastard ever won a war by dying for his country. He won it by making the other poor dumb bastard die for his country.
This is Patton, a salute to a rebel. A man whom the New York Times described in an editorial 2 days after his death as a legend, spectacular, swaggering, pistol-packing, deeply religious and violently profane, a strange combination of fire and ice.
Mussolini had regarded the mafia as a rival. He had broken up crime syndicates and imprisoned or executed mob bosses. Leaders in the United States and Britain took a more nuanced approach.
The cities were controlled by Mussolini, who had chased the old mob and the mafia up into the hills. And so Patton attacked through the mountain redoubts, and he brought with him a scarf with double L on it from Lucky Luciano as a symbol to Don Caligiuri-Vizzini, who was the head of the Italian mobs and the Don of the Dons at the time, for his credentials. And then Vizzini rode in the tank with him into these cheering cities of mafia-controlled elements in Italy who wanted revenge against Mussolini. 300 miles they penetrated without hardly any opposition. And Kiefaber, who later studied organized crime here in the United States and had hearings about it, had a special hearing to try to figure out what Patton had done and unearthed some of this information at the time. And after that, Patton's Third Army was called Lucky Forward, after Lucky Luciano.
From the 2004 film, Dead Men's Secrets.
Under the guise of being victims of fascism, mafia hitmen are released from Italian prisons. Mafia chiefs replace fascist mayors in Sicilian towns. All of this thanks to Lucky Luciano and his negotiations with the U.S. government. But the deal has a price tag. By using the mafia in wartime, the U.S. government helped reestablish the syndicate as a major criminal force, a force that will plague America for decades to come.
Yet the relationship between the intelligence agencies and organized crime would not stop there. On both sides of the Atlantic, the mob proved to be a valuable tool in attacking and corrupting labor unions.
Corsica and Marseille, these two islands in Italy, they had connections with the mob. And there was a chance after World War II, because if you study the actual resistance to Hitler and the underground resistance in World War II in both those countries, it was led primarily by the communists and the left. And so they were the ones that drove Hitler out, but the U.S. and the new Cold War mentality that the Nazis helped give them didn't want them to rise to power politically in those countries or want communism to spread. And so they then enlisted the mob, Naval Intelligence again, and then early OSS, Brown and Lovestone labor organizers, enlisted the mob to break the backs of the unions in Marseille. The reason they broke the back of the unions in Marseille was that they were actively opposing the French war in Indochina.
Philippe de Villiers. It
might be really repeated here. There is no two Vietnams. There is only one Vietnam, temporarily divided in Geneva in 54 between a free zone with the North Vietnam and an occupied zone occupied by the French. But then the French had still, after Geneva, the jurisdiction of over South Vietnam, because they could not hand it over to a regime which did not exist. It's not even mentioned in the Geneva Agreement. The regime of Saigon is only a temporary one in waiting for election.
Democratic Senator Wayne Morse.
When you ought to have sat with me on the Foreign Relations Committee in 1956, when our intelligence forces brought in their reports warning that if the election called for by the Geneva Accords for July 1956 were held, Ho Chi Minh would be elected president in South Vietnam by at least 80% of the vote. And our country, that boasts about believing in self-determination, used its power and its prestige and its influence really to get our first puppet government under GM not to cooperate in holding those elections. That's just a matter of historic record.
At the time, they were trying to stop the war opposition of the unions, and so by breaking their back, they opened up Marseille and the docks there to mob control. They already had it in Corsica, and so then that became the route for the heroin and the heroin profits to come down. That connection, or what was called the French connection out of Marseille, dominated a new money in the organized crime sector, and also included prostitution, drugs, and other criminal activity that the old mob wouldn't participate in.
This was Sicily in the mid-1980s. A gang war had broken out between competing mob bosses. In itself, this was not an unusual occurrence, but the body count was alarmingly high. 5 corpses were being found every single day. Other patterns were emerging. Where once the bosses had sought, though frequently failed, to abide by a code of honor, the new gang wars involved the slaughter of women and children. The escalation in violence corresponded with an escalation in drug traffic. Billions of dollars were now involved. In 1992, after decades of increasingly violent rule by the mafia, Sicilians took to the streets to demand their government take action. The uprising was precipitated by the assassination of Giovanni Falcone, who had launched the largest prosecution of the mob in history, only to be shut down by the Italian government. Finally, Italy's leaders responded. 7,000 army troops were sent into Sicily, and new anti-mafia legislation was passed. Government spokespersons declared that the war on the mafia had been won. This would soon prove to be an illusion. Though the Sicilian mafia had been temporarily beheaded, the same social conditions that had allowed the underworld to flourish remained in place. Like the Hydra, the mythical creature that grows 2 heads when one is severed, the mafia would emerge with newfound strength.
Non guardo niente.
Hear nothing, see nothing, say nothing.
Non ho mai parlato di...
Those three things will keep you alive.
That is the code of Italy's most violent mafia, the Camorra. And this is where its grip is strongest, Naples, a city in the heart of Europe. Its brutality is notorious. It's killed more people than the IRA.
It stands for death, terror, trauma, blood and tears.
But as senior insiders, who've never spoken publicly before, tell me, the power of the Camorra clans is all pervasive.
Take away the word Naples and leave the word Camorra. It's the city of the Camorra.
This organized crime syndicate rakes in billions by poisoning its own backyard with toxic waste. And the Camorra has polluted politics in Naples.
It used to be that the Camorrista would knock on the politician's door for favors. Today in this city is the politician who needs the Camorrista.
The Camorra has more blood on its hands than Sicily's infamous mafia. What will it take to stop it?
Today there are thousands of large-scale organized crime syndicates operating worldwide. In 2009, it was conservatively estimated to generate nearly $1 trillion, more than six times the amount of official development assistance for that year, and the equivalent of close to 7% of the world's exports of merchandise. That statistic from the United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime. From 60 Minutes, November the 21st, 1993.
But there was more disturbing news in the fall of 1993 when a report revealed that the government itself may have been running drugs. The head of the DEA at the time, Robert Bonner, said that a ton of pure cocaine worth hundreds of millions of dollars had been smuggled into the United States. And he blamed the CIA, saying the agency had joined the Venezuelan National Guard in drug smuggling.
Let me understand what you're saying. A ton of cocaine was smuggled into the United States of America by the Venezuelan National Guard?
Well, they...
In cooperation with the CIA?
That's exactly what appears to have happened.
Former DEA agent Levine said that equally shocking was the fact that for more than 30 years, the federal government had protected some drug dealers.
As officers in the narcotic war, we saw the political choice made up close and personal.
One example, Levine said, was during the Nixon administration when he was about to bust a major source of heroin.
And I was stopped cold, because that source were our allies in the Vietnam War.
Levine said this was not an isolated incident, that it had happened many times in his 25-year career.
If it was a question of supporting people who supported our economic and political philosophies in other parts of the world, and they happened to be drug dealers, as most of them are, we supported them and we protected them.
Dennis Dale stated, quote, "In my 30-year history in the Drug Enforcement Administration and related agencies, the major targets of my investigations almost invariably turned out to be working for the CIA," unquote.
It's very hard to point to an area of the world where you have major drug trafficking where the CIA has not been a factor in allowing that drug trade to prosper because of the protection which they conferred upon their assets. The CIA, in trying to create an anti-communist presence in Southeast Asia, they were very worried, especially after China went communist. The CIA built up what was left of Chiang Kai-shek's Kuomintang, which always had financed itself by the drug traffic. And starting officially in the year 1951, the CIA's Operation Paper started supplying arms and other material assistance to a group of KMT former soldiers in Burma, whose main activity was controlling the drug traffic there and exporting drugs out of Burma, mostly through Thailand. to Hong Kong, to Taiwan, and eventually to the United States. This grew with time and came to support a whole CIA private army in Thailand, which was then used to stir up war in Laos, and really is a neglected factor in the origins of the Vietnam War, the American Vietnam War. The CIA began going into Afghanistan after the communists seized power there in 1978. They actually were in there a bit before and may have helped by their support of the right to have precipitated that communist coup. But in a big way, the CIA became involved in Afghanistan after December 1979.
U.S. National Security Advisor Brzezinski flew to Pakistan to set about rallying resistance. He wanted to arm the Mujahideen without revealing America's role. On the Afghan border near the Khyber Pass, he urged the soldiers of God to redouble their efforts.
We know of their deep belief in God, and we are confident that their struggle will succeed.
The CIA support went not to the general Afghan resistance, but to those parts of the Afghan resistance which were trusted by the Saudis and above all by Pakistan. And Pakistan was frightened of a genuinely popular resistance movement because most of the resistance didn't like the Durand Line, which is the official frontier between Pakistan and Afghanistan, and which divides the Pashtun people. It even divides tribes and families. So all the aid went to those people who would recognize the Durand Line. And these were mostly protégés of the Pakistani intelligence service, the ISI, and who found a convenient situation to support themselves against the rest by getting involved in the drug traffic, not just moving drugs, but even developing heroin factories inside those parts of Afghanistan and Pakistan which were under ISI control. In the very early stages of U.S. support for Afghanistan resistance, all that aid was channeled through a bank called the Bank of Credit and Commerce International.
To keep the authorities in the dark and prop up their empires, BCCI and Gulf set up an elaborate money-go-round. Depositors ranging from the Sheikh of Abu Dhabi to ordinary customers put their money into BCCI accounts, but a secret route was needed to divert it to Gulf. To do this, Gulf set up dozens of shadow companies in places like Liberia and Panama, where ownership can be kept secret. These companies opened accounts with BCCI, through which money started to flow. They recycled money between them and to other specially created Indian trading companies, so it looked as if real business was taking place. The shadow companies opened bank accounts in New York and channeled the money there, but these accounts were also controlled by Gulf. Gulf returned some of the money to BCCI, so it appeared BCCI was making profits.
And this was a bank which was getting rich by laundering drug money, had a direct stake in the drug trade, and actually may, according to some people who've written about it, have been directly involved in the drug trade itself, as well as in creating balances for drug traffickers. From the very beginning, American aid was skewed away from what an outsider would have said would have been the obvious recipients of aid in Afghanistan, and went to these two outside groups, Abu Sayyaf and Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, neither of whom had a very solid base in Afghanistan, and both groups being involved in the drug traffic. It's a real tragedy that perhaps half of all U.S. aid given to the Afghan resistance in the 1980s was given to this one man, Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, who at the time was the world's biggest drug trafficker. The CIA has to face the fact that wherever they have been active, I mean, the world's heroin today is coming from three countries is coming, all of them countries where the CIA has been active, most of it in Afghanistan, which where we have been hyperactive recently with the world's largest CIA station. And it's worth mentioning that before the CIA went into Afghanistan in the late 1970s, Afghanistan had never been a factor in the world drug trade. There had been opium grown, but it was locally consumed. Afghanistan now produces, I think, 93% of the world's heroin. Before that, it was Indochina, until America got out of Indochina. It was producing about 90% of the world's heroin. And the failure of the U.S. media to note this very obvious correlation between CIA activity and drug production is one of the reasons that we have such a problem on our hands, because it's only a few of us who are sort of, for this reason, denied access to the mainstream media, who keep pointing out the obvious, that there's a correlation between CIA activity and drug production. The third area is Colombia.
Little was known about BCCI until six of its top officers were arrested in Tampa in October of 1988 on charges of laundering drug money for Colombian cocaine bosses. The BCCI men were convicted, and the bank itself pleaded guilty. But for some reason, the bank was allowed to continue to operate all over the world. And investigators say U.S. prosecutors failed to follow up on evidence of widespread corruption and other crimes that this month finally led to the bank being shut down.
I don't want to say that we invented cocaine production there, but it has massively increased since it was originally 1962, I think, when under Kennedy, the United States were very concerned about Castro having taken over in Cuba and frightened that he would export revolution to Latin America, and Colombia would be like the coastline that is closest to Cuba. So they initiated an anti-communist program there, which was successful in creating two things. First of all, a great escalation in the a number of drug traffickers in Colombia and the amount of drugs produced in Colombia, but also in the amount of terrorism, because a lot of ordinary trade unionists, once they had this CIA-supported anti-communist drive to deal with, they decided that their only protection was to become a militant revolutionary movement. So it was, I think, a disastrous move on two levels, not just the drug level, but also the terrorism level. And now, in Colombia, terrorism and anti-terrorism is a drug-related industry on both sides.
William I. Robinson, American professor of sociology at the Union of California, Santa Barbara.
But specifically with Colombia, the closest ally that the two allies that the U.S. has right now in Latin America is Mexico and Colombia. Colombia is the worst human rights violator in Latin America. Over 3,000 trade unionists have been murdered in the last 10 years. In fact, thousands of journalists have been murdered in the last few decades. The most dangerous place to be in the world if you are a trade unionist is Colombia. The most dangerous place to be in the world if you are a journalist is Colombia. Over 3 million people have been displaced from the land in Colombia by right-wing paramilitary units that then, once that land is displaced, they turn that land over to transnational corporations, to local planters and investors, to local capitalists. And so Colombia is basically a terrorist regime. It's a terror state. It's a nightmare straight state for the poor majority. And this is the state which the U.S. is totally aligned with. And so you might ask, why is that the case? Well, U.S. strategy has been to use Colombia as a beachhead to try and regain influence in Latin America. So Obama comes in and says Colombia is the best friend of the United States.
And today President Santos and I reviewed our progress, and I'm pleased to say reached agreement on several new initiatives. First, as has already been mentioned, we're moving ahead with our landmark trade agreement.
Well, if what you mean by the United States is the dominant system, the rulers in the United States, Colombia is the best friend of the United States. And what the U.S. can do now is attempt to regain its influence by trying to beef up Colombia, strengthen Colombia, and use Colombia as a staging point to counter the pink tide. Or the United States might come up with a more sophisticated strategy of accepting some type of reform in Latin America and accommodating itself to that reform. I think that's the seen from the viewpoint of the U.S. political elite, that's the challenge that it faces.
In 2010, the former head of death squads in Colombia, Juan Manuel Santos, claimed to have won the presidential election. Voter abstention was estimated at over 75%. Shortly before, the largest mass grave in Colombian history was discovered. Located just outside of an army base in La Macerna, it was revealed when children drinking from a nearby stream became ill from the toxic effects of decomposing flesh. An editorial in the New York Times described Santos as a role model for Latin America.
Hundreds of bodies buried in unmarked graves. The cemetery in La Macarena has become President Álvaro Uribe's nightmare in his last days in office. La Macarena is located deep into the Colombian jungle, in a place that was once controlled by the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, or FARC. Human rights groups claim that there could be up to 2,000 bodies buried here, right behind the largest Colombian military base in the area. The government claims the dead were guerrillas, but people in the area say many were innocent civilians. Raquel Benavides certainly thinks so. She says her son was killed by the military and passed off as a guerrilla fighter. He was found in a mass grave.
They killed my son for holidays, for some cash. They killed him so that the government would get more money from abroad. I feel anger because my son was an educated person and he was the light of my eyes.
Uribe's government has been dogged by revelations that thousands of young poor men and women were killed to increase the combat body count and then presented as guerrillas. In exchange, their killers got rewards.
People in the area say that most of the bodies that were buried here were brought by the Colombian military. And as you can see, they were buried in unmarked graves. This number is the number of the registry in the cemetery, and 2010 is the year they were killed.
The president visited the area to reaffirm his support for Colombia's military.
In 1988, Martha Gomez's husband was murdered by an army death squad masquerading as a paramilitary group. At the time, he worked in a local banana plantation, and the workers there were striking for better pay and conditions. When Martha's husband was ordered to break the strike, he refused, and the paramilitaries beat him to a pulp. 9 years later, Martha's parents and sister were also murdered by paramilitaries in the same town.
They have a way of killing. They cut their heads off. Many people were disemboweled and their innards thrown in the river. This is the way they do it. They are laying down the seeds of terror so people will respect them, listen to them, and obey them.
And that's where we leave the video this week due to time. Whilst I understand the natural abhorrence to close investigation of what the Secret Services are doing, I think it's helpful for anybody like myself who pays taxes to national governments to take a clear look at what we are involved in. And I wouldn't be as committed as I am to working on alternatives to the money system if I hadn't clearly understood some of the dark forces which it arouses in people and which it amplifies in societies and the world at large. If you'd like to download the audio from this show or any previous episodes, you can do so from our MP3 archive at unwelcomeguests.net/archive. Our theme tune is by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Keep giving all you can to those around you. The more we can give, the weaker the hold the money has over us all.